Greetings, friends. Welcome back to Critically Acclaimed, the film review podcast, where good taste and bad taste have a sound effect. It's wonderful. My name is Whitney Seibel. I am a film critic. Mm-hmm. I am a senior staff writer over at Slash Film, and with me, as always, is the real star of the show.
Ah!
The intellectual giant to my intellectual amoeba. William, why don't you introduce yourself here?
Don't understand why you do that to me. You know how I hate praise. My name is William Bibbiani. I am a film critic. I write for The Wrap, and everybody calls me Bibbs.
I want you to know I don't do it specifically to make you uncomfortable.
But you know it does.
No, I want you to say thank you. I'm training you to accept praise.
Well, it's what we have, like 2,000 episodes so far, and it hasn't kicked in yet?
It'll catch on. Okay. I'm holding out hope. I'm a hopeful guy.
That's a literal number, by the way. Anyway, this is Critically Acclaimed. We review new movies. On this podcast, and by God, do we have some of them. This week, on Critically Acclaimed, we're reviewing the new Robert Zemeckis tech demo here, Clint Eastwood's legal thriller Juror Number 2, Steve McQueen's World War II drama Blitz, the Netflix What If Back to the Future Was a Slasher Movie Time Cut, the Liam Neeson movie with Liam Neeson in it, Absolution, starring Liam Neeson, and a documentary called No Other Land. That is what we'll be reviewing.
That's right.
On this podcast. If you follow me on the socials, or if you're a member of our Patreon, patreon.com/criticallyacclaimednetwork, you may have heard that I actually had a cool announcement this week.
That's right.
I might as well throw it out here as well. I am writing a book.
He has a book deal, guys.
That makes it sound like I'm making money. No, it's a book deal. It's not. I'm not, you know, like, oh, here's a $200,000 advance. Now go to the Bahamas and write it.
Research.
Like it is in the movies. It's a little bit not quite that magical, but it is very, very exciting, and I'm very, very stoked about it. And
can you say what the book is going
to be? Yeah, we've announced the subject and the title. It is called This Is Halloween, The Cinematic Guide to Everyone's Actual Favorite Holiday. And the idea is pretty simple. Christmas movies are talked about a lot. People love Christmas movies. People watch the same movies set at Christmas time every year. But at Halloween, we watch horror movies, and I love horror movies.
Uh-huh.
But I think Halloween movies are their own genre as well, and I don't think we talk about that enough. So I'll be looking at the depiction of Halloween in various movies and genres, not just horror, throughout movie history, from the silent era to the present day. That's a big topic, and not a lot's been written about it, so I'm very excited.
I'm excited to hear your research, because I know a lot of it is contingent on the way Halloween has been celebrated, just historically.
Yeah.
I think that's going to be really interesting.
Yeah.
As we've mentioned in the past, Halloween, sort of as we know it today, didn't really start to explode in popularity until really it was like the 1980s.
Late 1970s, early 1980s.
That it became like this sort of big commercial enterprise.
Yeah.
And
it was still pretty obscure in a lot of the world.
Yeah.
Like it just wasn't that well recognized a holiday. The actual like cinematic depictions of Halloween are actually a lot slimmer than you might think until that era, largely because people didn't think people would be that interested, or perhaps they'd be confused in other countries where they don't have Halloween. So I've got a lot of research to do, not just on the holiday itself, but I have to like track down hard to find movies, some of which may be lost. So, it's exciting and it's going to take up a lot of my time. And the goal is to have it out, in time for next Halloween. So I really got to get this thing going. So that's going to be my year, basically.
Fantastic.
It's just writing that thing. So, a lot of people have said very kind words. Thank you. Thank you everybody who said they would be interested in like pre-ordering it. We're not there yet. But when the time comes, I'll let you know. And if you follow me on social media at William Bibbiani on Instagram, Twitter, Blue Sky,
you can
get updates.
Give us a little preview. What's a word you use in it?
Well, I was thinking about obsequious.
Ooh.
Yeah, no.
That's an excellent word.
No, there's, I think certain things probably people can guess. There's going to be a chapter on the Halloween movie franchise.
Uh-huh.
I want to do a chapter about sort of the golden age of the depiction of Halloween in movies, because there's less of it than you might think. Probably a whole chapter dedicated to adaptations of Sleepy Hollow, stuff like that. So, but I don't want to give it all away. They've got some cool ideas, a brewing. Yeah, just thank everybody for the kind words, and I'll keep you updated when there's stuff to be updated about.
All right.
Yeah. So just the elephant in the room. It has been addressed. It is time to move on. Let's review some goddamn movies. None of which, unless juror number two is about something I'm not aware of, take place on or around Halloween, really.
No. And actually, juror number two does take place on Halloween.
No.
It does.
Really?
It takes place almost like in the present day. Because I saw it on its opening weekend, and they mentioned the date, and it was that day that I went to go see it. Like, it was super, like,
weird.
Creepy.
Okay, well, I guess I will have to see that movie.
But yeah, there is a scene that's set on Halloween night.
All right. Well...
Would you like me to start with Halloween, or with Halloween Red One, Juror Number Two, whatever the hell this movie's called?
I think we should start with the big one that we both saw.
All right.
So let's start with Here. And here, we'll move on to Juror Number Two.
Here is the latest, you called it a demo reel. What do you call it? Like,
I think I called it a tech demo.
A tech demo from Robert Zemeckis. Robert Zemeckis has always been, I feel like he's an adjunct to Steven Spielberg, not just because they work together a lot, but I feel like he makes movies in a similar mold.
Mm-hmm.
He has, I don't want to say he has edge, because that's not what he has, but he has a little bit more of an adult sensibility than Steven Spielberg.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like they evolved similarly. Like, they started with these light, brisk entertainments and moved into things that could, are ostensibly more adult. Like, Robert Zemeckis eventually turned to things like Castaway and What Lies Beneath.
And Forrest Gump, famously.
Forrest Gump is his most famous one. His most adult film was, one of his more recent, was called Allied.
I still haven't seen Allied. That's one of the ones I haven't seen.
Which is fair.
He's had such an odd evolution, because he's gone through multiple permutations. There was the initial era where he was making things like Used Cars and Back to the Future and Who Framed Roger Rabbit, Romancing the Stone. These increasingly ambitious... Mm. Very high concept movies for the most part, and they were comedies, and they were very slick. Mm-hmm. And as they progressed, he started pushing more at the medium. What kind of visual effects can I use? How can I incorporate animation and live action?
In the early to mid 2000s, when CGI was becoming just sort of the dominant special effects force, he started to do fully animated movies.
Well, I think he even skipped an era, because Robert Zemeckis also in the 90s. Mm. Executive produced Tales from the Crypt, and helped executive produce like a lot of the Dark Sky William Castle remakes, like House on Haunted Hill, 13 Ghosts. He did Death Becomes Her.
Oh, that's true. He directed Death Becomes Her. He had this horror era. He produced The Frighteners, which was supposed to be a Tales from the Crypt movie.
Yeah. And then he moved into Forrest Gump, which was this huge Oscar-winning drama. And then he got more into the prestige stuff for a little bit. You mentioned Castaway. And yeah, then he got really into the idea of motion capture animation.
Mm.
Like, obsessed with it. And he made multiple films. He made Polar Express.
Polar Express. Beowulf.
Beowulf and Christmas Carol.
Yeah.
In rapid succession.
And he also did Welcome to Marwen, which had a lot of that motion capture stuff.
I didn't see Welcome to Marwen either, but the thing with when you're trying to like pioneer technology in cinema is if the technology isn't there yet, your movie might age badly. And I would argue that something like Polar Express aged badly the week it came out. Because it seems exciting, right? We're going to use this whole new animation technique. We're going to do an entire film with this sort of kind of magical, almost puppety sheen to it. Tom Hanks can play multiple characters. Isn't that interesting for Tom Hanks? And everything is a dead-eyed corpse. It's just not there yet.
Well, I feel like the big issue is, and people, you can look to something like Avatar for this. Mm-hmm. That's a James Cameron film.
Yeah.
But that has some of the best special effects ever, like especially up to that point.
Yeah.
It really photorealistic motion capture stuff, really dazzling visual digital like forest scapes and dragons and stuff.
Yeah.
But I think a lot of people are really negative about Avatar because the screenplay is pretty mawkish and the characters are really thin. You look at something like Who Framed Roger Rabbit, which blends hand-drawn animation with live-action footage, and they used a lot of really complicated practical effects to make all of that stuff happen.
Mm-hmm.
The, and that it all looks really fantastic, but it also has a great screenplay.
Yeah, it's not like Space Jam where they just threw something. I mean, yeah. I'm sure Space Jam was complicated, but the gimmick was the point, not the movie. Who Framed Roger Rabbit was a really good story.
Yeah, it was a good noir story. Eddie Valiant, the main human character, was an interesting character, played by a really great actor. Like, he had an arc. All these characters, like, developed in interesting ways in something like Who Framed Roger Rabbit. When you have the tech, but not the screenplay, it's the whole movie's going to fall apart. It doesn't matter how good the tech is.
Yeah. And if the tech isn't good, all the worse.
Yeah.
Unfortunately.
Beowulf looks fine, I guess.
It's okay.
It's okay.
Yeah. It was certainly a big step forward after Polar Express.
Yeah.
And kudos for trying to make something more mature, you know, like an actual, like, serious adventure adaptation of a classic mythological tale. And there's some interesting stuff in it. But it's still feels kind of corpsey to me.
And I feel like that's been Zemeckis' thing. He's been more focused on the tech and the gimmick than he has been on the story and the characters.
Yeah.
He can do story and characters. We've seen it before.
Yeah.
But now he's much more interested in the other thing. And I feel like as he's gotten older, he's gotten a heck of a lot more sentimental. And that's certainly the case with Here.
Yeah.
And the gimmick with Here is that it's a fixed camera.
It's only one single shot.
Although they cleverly edit by like having these square comic book panels sort of fade in and out, so it kind of fades in and out in pieces.
Yeah.
So there's kind of like a lot of visual variety, and it skips back and forth throughout the history of this one place. In fact, it even starts in prehistoric times. Very briefly, we see some dinosaurs.
Yeah.
And we kind of see this one era. Let's go through the history points. There's a bit of First Nation people.
For like maybe two or three minutes.
For two or three scenes. There's a scene of Benjamin Franklin's illegitimate brother.
No, son.
Or son.
It was his son. His son was actually a British sympathizer.
That's right.
This is actually a true backstory of Benjamin Franklin. It's kind of the shame of the family.
So we get to see that. There's a phase in like about 1900 where there's an aviator and his worried wife who's worried he's going to crash the plane. Mm.
There's a bit in like the 30s or early 40s with this very, very happy young couple and they are building the Lazy Boy for the very first time. But the majority of the movie, like the vast majority of the movie, is the story of a family in the mid-20th century who move in after World War II.
That's when we skip to Paul Bettany and Kelly Reilly.
Yeah.
Who play a young couple who are moving into this new house. It's not new at that point.
Yeah.
Moving into this house for the first time in like the mid-1940s.
Yeah.
He's a soldier who's injured and bitter and alcoholic.
Yeah.
And she's trying to make the family work. And they have a couple kids there. Their son grows up to be Tom Hanks, and he continues to live there.
Yeah, and through the use of CGI de-aging, Tom Hanks plays himself from a teenager onward. Same thing with Robin Wright, who plays his girlfriend. She gets pregnant. It kind of derails all of their plans, and they end up moving in with his parents and living a life of quiet desperation for decades. And then there's a little bit that happens afterwards, but it doesn't go very far.
Well, there's also, there is a modern family, because that takes place, like, from the 40s up until
the 80s or 90s.
Like, maybe the 90s, and then we get to see a little bit of the family after that, and it's a...
It's a pretty, I don't know if they're rich, but it's a nice house.
Yeah, kind of like an upscale, like they have a maid.
Yeah.
This upscale black family moves in.
Yeah.
And the only reason I can think that Zemeckis included... the modern family and the First Nation people was just so he didn't have all white people in his movie.
But the problem is though, is that they have so little screen time and so little like to do really with the narrative that they end up only highlighting the fact that Robert Zemeckis is making a story that encompasses, you know, not unlike something like The Tree of Life, the sum totality of human existence. And the only thing he can think to focus on is boomers.
Yeah, this boomer family growing up in the suburbs.
That history peaked with this suburban house and a bunch of boomers. And here's the thing. A lot of great movies have been made about boomers. That's true. They've been around a lot. They've been controlling things for a long time. they've had a lot of opportunities.
Around.
And that's okay. I'm not saying that's inherently a bad thing. But when A... theoretically, you've got all of human history to play with, and that's the vast majority of your screen time, it's worth pointing out. And B, nothing that interesting happens to them.
No, and in fact, nothing interesting happens to them. It's a pretty typical story.
Yeah, like generic
and
life,
and it's really mawkish the way they play with time. There's a few shots where Robin Wright kind of walks right up to the camera and just sort of says, God, time flies, doesn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, I'll take a drink every time someone says that or something.
Something too. Along the lines of how time just keeps on passing.
Makes you think.
No, it doesn't. That's the problem. I was going to say that Robert Zemeckis has no point he's making with this. The gimmick isn't being exploited. He's not talking about how, time changes the landscape of America. He's not talking about how something has been destroyed in order to build something else, or vice versa.
He's not putting things in significant historical context.
There's no historical context, whatever. Yeah. I saw a film last year. It was the last Steve McQueen movie.
That documentary he did. What was it like? Wasn't it called like Time Something?
It wasn't called Open City. It was.
I'll look it up. You just move on.
But yeah, it was quite a long documentary. It was a 4-hour documentary film of Steve McQueen and his partner wandering around with a camera filming modern day Amsterdam. And they essentially went from...
Occupied City,
that was it. And Occupied City found, like, buildings where there had been some occupations, where there had been war atrocities, where people had been hiding out, where scholars used to live. It was trying to sort of reclaim the actual wartime geography and how time tends to deliberately reshape that in a way that is, it's a little bit profound because you can just sort of stand in one spot and ponder. It's like, wait a minute, something significant happened on this spot and you'd never know from looking. Sometimes you do know from looking. There's a plaque there. But the geography is made to swallow it up.
Yeah.
And a lot of the actual just natural evolution
especially
and building
urban area,
just architectural trends tend to swallow history and make us forget.
Yeah.
So there's actually like commentary on memory and city planning and how all of these things kind of mesh. Nothing like that in here. Here just is just here. I think Zemeckis is trying to get us to feel, oh, isn't it sweet that all of these significant things can happen in one spot in the country? The problem is none of these things are significant. It's the... Yeah. It's a TV commercial. If you've ever watched like a Hallmark ad.
Oh yeah, is definitely
for a Hallmark movie. That is like for Hallmark greeting cards.
Well,
it is about as emotionally moving, but it's just a feature of it.
I would actually recommend. I would argue that the best version of this film is the trailer for this film because you get the gist of it, and then you don't have to see the rest.
Yeah, it works perfectly well in 3 minutes.
Because it's frustrating how little you're right. How little he gets out of it, and you're talking about how it's not like nothing that happens in it that's significant. And I'm watching it and I'm realizing none of this is significant, but I'm wondering, okay, maybe that's what he's getting at. Is that even though history is grand and it encompasses all these different people, all these different eras, people are always just people. And there's a lot of little parallel moments that he tries to strike where someone does one thing 100 years ago and someone in the same place does the same thing later. Sometimes it's literally the same thing. Sometimes it's like a baffling connection, and I don't understand why he thinks it's profound. Like, there's a leaky roof in the living room. Oh, man. And then, like, 10 years later, someone's water breaks in the same spot. Mm. Oh, the water broke in different ways in the same place. And I'm like, and? So I'm thinking to myself, is this about the little things? And I'm thinking, you know, you equated it to this, you know, profound documentary, and I'm thinking about Tree of Life, which, you know, Terrence Malick, he doesn't always nail it. He used to have a perfect track record, and then he made, like, Night of Cups and a couple other not very good ones. But for a while there, he was making these, like, tapestry movies.
Yeah.
Like, the Thin Red Line,
Tree of Life,
and To the Wonder, which is very underrated, I feel. And those movies, especially the latter two, are about how, like, the small moments are everything.
Mm.
Like, the little tiny snippets of memory that, like, clog our brains are the most important things. And
they do connect to life and death and eternity and all of history.
Yeah, because we can all, even if we can't sympathize with each other's circumstances, we've all been a child and looked up at something.
Yeah.
You know, and that's something that's kind of universal. Here, It doesn't feel universal. It feels contrived and specific to a, weirdly to a fault. And that's something that we've argued a lot, that specificity breeds universality. And here, apparently not.
I feel like it would have been a lot more effective if he didn't cut around through history, if he'd just done it chronologically. If there was like a long, like in 2001, there was like long prehistoric segment and then another segment. The movie I was reminded most of was actually A Ghost Story.
Yeah, it's got a lot of that too.
David Lowery did that.
David Lowery, yeah.
A Ghost Story is, you know, it takes place in a house. A young couple is living there. The man gets in a wreck and he dies. And he comes back as a ghost, but it's like classical sheet over the head kind of ghost with the eye holes.
Yeah.
That's the way the ghost looks, but nobody can see the ghost.
And he's just there throughout many years.
And that's... what I like about that, the ghost story, is like he's there and is haunting the place, but if nobody can ever see a ghost and it's just sort of haunting a place, it's just sort of, just occupying this space.
It's just observing.
And, and after a while, the ghost that doesn't age, it's dead, is just sort of standing. There's a really great scene where it like looks out the window, can't leave the house, but it sees a ghost in the house across the way, and they communicate through subtitles because they can't speak. It's like, what are you? I don't remember what I was.
Yeah.
I'm just a thing now. Just like vague bits of consciousness lingering.
Yeah, this little sense memory of a place that just lingers even if no one is conscious of it ever again.
Yeah, and as it lingers there, it can't do anything but observe, and time just keeps on passing. And it actually gets to see people move out, people move back into this place.
The future.
We get to see the future. We get to see it turn into a high rise. And then the movie also argues that time is kind of cyclical and meaningless when you get to that point. So it's also in the past simultaneously.
Yeah.
And it sees people dying, and it sees the house get built around it after a while. It's like that, I feel like, is tapping into the eternity of the thing.
Yeah.
It's seeing time as something much larger. Here has no sense of that. It's this mawkish Hollywood entertainment that sees everything as very linear and very easy to consume in a way that it makes it really distasteful.
Which is weird, because I think the whole point is that it's not linear. This is based on a graphic novel by Richard McGuire, which was originally a short, I think it was like 6 or 8 pages. That was basically, I mean, I haven't read the long version, I read the short version. It wasn't very narrative driven at all. It was basically just trying to make you think about all the different times that occupy a space. It's very daring. Yeah. It's just really challenges the visual medium and how we view time visually. And, you know, movie has the capacity to do that already. It's called editing. And, you know, you could maybe think of this as a complicated split screen technique, and there's something to that. But the problem is that when you do this whole single locked shot motif, I mean, you're picking where the shot's going to be. And they pick a slightly high angle just shot of a living room from the corner of the room. So you get most of the room. And then you have to really force everything to happen in that room. And it ends up feeling like a crappy dinner theater. It's just everyone just sort of walking to the room, like talking off camera. Well, doesn't matter if it makes any sense. If we do finally get a sense of like maybe what the rest of the house might look like, you realize no one uses the dining room. Like this is not one. This is not a one room house. Like it's just
there's one shot where they kind of cheat a little bit. There's a bit with a mirror where we get to see other parts of the house because the shot is locked down and we want to get a sort of a reflection of it. But
They have Thanksgiving dinner in the living room, but we know there's a dining room next to it that had plenty of space for everybody. What are we even doing here? It's so forced.
A lot can happen in a living room. It's a lot of incident, right?
Yeah.
It would have been so much more fun if it had been a bedroom.
Would have been very interesting.
Or a bathroom, even.
Yeah.
I mean,
or a front yard or something. Yeah. Like, it's a lot of different possibilities, and
They picked
a boring one.
There are movies that sort of take suburban life, ordinary suburban life, and try to turn it into something epic.
Yeah. The Burbs. Speaking of Tom Hanks.
I was thinking of something like Boyhood. Like Boyhood, we actually get to see the kid grow up.
Another one that plays with time.
Yeah, and it's also this big time experiment. It took 12 years to make.
I love that you and Boyhood, I went the Burbs. We're very different people sometimes.
Well, I really love Boyhood.
Yeah, I really love the Burbs.
Richard Lynch, there's a scene near the end of Boyhood where the main character has grown to be, he's about 17, he's just graduated high school.
Yeah.
And they're like, he's, you know, kind of awkwardly wearing the gown.
Turned into a gangly kid.
Yeah, kind of a gangly kid, and he's like, got his diploma, and he's just sort of holding it up, and they're posing for pictures, and like, that is a heart-wrenching moment. It's like, so much went into just making this simple moment of
light,
joy, and life.
Yeah.
Like, we actually get to see something profound happening in that moment.
Sure.
There's no profundity at all.
No.
To hear.
It's cloying.
And Robert Zemeckis tries to bring it together with the, like, most boring visual motifs.
Oh, yeah.
Like you said, the water breaking with the leak in the roof. There's a recurring motif with a hummingbird, which doesn't make any sense.
It's not
sense.
Connected to anything. No, they never actually get into what that could refer to.
Shred of thought in this movie, and it's aggravating. Because I've seen Zemeckis do really good movies.
A lot of really
good
movies. I've
liked a lot of his movies.
Yeah. Even the ones I don't like, I usually kind of respect a lot.
Yeah.
Like, it's like, okay, well, listen, that one didn't work for me, but he was trying something new, or this part really worked very well, this is a great performance, and this is...
I think about Castaway a lot.
Sure.
It's not a, you know, a grand cinema classic, but it's one that kind of sticks in the memory.
You know one I like that no one else really cared for very much, but it stuck with me, was The Walk.
The Walk is really good.
The Walk is really good. People thought it was... The Walk was a movie he made starring Joseph Gordon-Levitt about the guy in real life who did a wire walk routine between the Twin Towers.
While they were being built in the 70s.
Shortly, like right around the time they opened up. And it was a big deal, and they made an Oscar-winning documentary. It won an Oscar, right? Man on Wire?
Yeah, Man on Wire.
Yeah, made a documentary about it. But the problem with that documentary was... No one got footage of him doing it.
Yeah, nobody thought to bring a camera up there.
So they're all just so worried about making sure he didn't die. Nobody filmed it. And so Robert Zemeckis was like, okay, well, listen, Man on Wire is great, but I want to know what it was like to be on that wire. And so he puts you there. And
he was like this really deep focused 3D photography.
Yeah.
And put it on IMAX screens. And we saw it that way.
Yeah, that's
And it'll give you vertigo in the best possible way.
That
is
a movie.
Exhilarating.
There's so many great movies out there. And it's like, oh, you should see it in theater. And you should. But they work fine on TV. The Walk is so much more amazing in IMAX.
Yeah.
Like, it legitimately should be seen that way.
Yeah, if you missed it in 3D, you kind of missed the height of the way it was meant to be seen.
And the rest of that movie is just okay, but it's about this experience that he can give you. And he can use technology to give you something you couldn't experience otherwise.
Yeah.
And theoretically, that should be here, but in actuality, no, we have editing for that. Mm. And we've had all these other examples that have come up. Boyhood, the Occupied City, Tree of Life, that have done a better version of this without the gimmickry. Mm. And also, the CGI aging, really hit or miss.
I feel like on Tom Hanks, they nailed it pretty well. I think because we've seen young Tom Hanks, and I think...
They had a lot of visual reference to
work so they were able to go with that. Robin Wright looks a little plastic.
Especially when she's younger. Like, they're really struggling to, like, make... I don't know. Again, we know what she looks like. Like, Princess Bride era, like, Robin Wright, and she does not look like that. So I know that's off. And that's probably what it is. I'm just conscious of it.
Yeah.
You know?
And another thing. There's so much to complain about this movie.
Yeah.
It's so terrible. I also wanted there to be a little bit of darkness to it, a little bit of bleakness. Nothing interesting happens, and there is some interesting, like, somebody has their first sexual encounter in that room, the people get married in that room, they have dinners in that room,
marriages die in the house,
people die, like, several people die in that room. So dramatic things do happen, but there's never anything like, something criminal happens in that room. Somebody like morally compromises in that room. There's no actual like hard edge to the human drama. There's nothing really believable about it.
Yeah,
we kind of see
everything happen in this room except something bad.
Yeah, you know, like there's arguments, but they're not really horrendous arguments. There's confessions of like infidelity, but it's not something that rips the marriage apart. There's absolutely no bleakness. There's no edge. It's so soft that it starts to become unbelievable after a while.
Yeah,
and I hate that.
Yeah, it's
like I'm just longing it to be more than what it's showing me. At the very least, he wasn't so indulgent that he wants this thing to go on for like 3 hours. He didn't think this is going to be an epic. It's like 104 minutes and that's fine.
Already that feels quite long. Like I said, the trailer is the movie.
Mm.
You get it. And this is something that Robert Zemeckis has said a lot. People criticized, like when the movie Castaway came out, the trailer told you whether or not he got off the island.
Yeah.
And people are like, why would you do that? And Robert Zemeckis is like, in my experience, people want to know the whole movie before they see it.
Yeah, yeah.
It's not a popular opinion, but it worked. People paid to see that movie. My point is this. Getting the whole movie in short form is not something we're used to with Robert Zemeckis.
Mm.
Except this is the only time I can think of where, no, we got the whole movie. Like, it wasn't like, yeah, but we see the longer, more expanded, more interesting, more fleshed out, narratively rich, thematic version of the movie is the long version. And here, the short version is just the same.
Yeah.
Like, you miss bits. I'm not saying there aren't, like, interesting moments, but
you say the trailer, I say a 30-second TV spot could just as easily communicate everything.
I'm willing to give it another 60 seconds, but okay.
30 seconds, you put the...
How about this? Read the fucking book.
You put the Coca-Cola logo at the end, and it's exactly as powerful. That's the kind of movie we're looking at here.
Oh, you're talking about like those like Coca-Cola shorts they show like before a movie?
No, like just an actual Coke ad.
Like an actual
Coke
ad. Like
a Christmas Coke ad.
Oh, yeah.
Where it's like really kind of sentimental, and we see like... This is what it looks like 1 million years ago. This is what it looked like 2,000 years ago. And then this one family had such a life here, and they nearly forgot everything. But then new people moved in, and everything moved on. Circle of life. Drink Coke. It's like I just gave you the movie. That's all you need.
One of my favorite commercials ever is you said it doesn't have an edge. It's like that with an edge. Spike Jones did a commercial for I think it was IKEA, and it was someone like a lamp on someone's desk and like kind of sad music's playing as this person like unplugs the lamp, puts it in a box, puts the box out on the street, and like you see, and you're always on the lamp, and then you kind of look up, and it's like a low angle, and you can see like the new lamp on the desk, and it's raining, and it looks like the lamp is crying, and then this is like a 30-second spot, and then like a guy just walks up to the camera and says, "Some of you may feel bad for this lamp. That is because you're crazy. It's a lamp. The new one is better." IKEA.
That's great.
It's great because it has all that sentimentality, but it's also like, look, we're just selling you
undercuts
crap.
It, yeah.
We're just selling you crap.
And that's what Zemeckis did. He sold us crap.
Kind of did. Anyway, tell me about Juror Number 2.
Juror Number 2 is the latest film, I think it's his 44th film as a director, from Clint Eastwood, who is in his early 90s and he's still directing. People say this could be his last movie. I wouldn't be surprised if he gets 5 more in the next year and a half.
He works so goddamn fast.
He is a quick worker. That's the reason he gets a lot of his movies made.
Yeah.
If you look up the making of The Bridges of Madison County, which I know that's a long time ago at this point.
In the 90s, yeah.
But they were getting this in development. They were trying to find directors. They couldn't get anything in. The budgets were ballooning. It's like, what do we do? We don't know where to shoot this thing. Clint Eastwood came into the office and said, "Do you want to make that movie? Give me 48 hours. He went out to Iowa. He shot like a couple pictures of bridges. He came back like a day and a half later. He's like, "I'm going to shoot here, here, and here. And I can probably get Meryl Streep." And they're like, "Okay, go."
Clint Eastwood actually...
And he shot it in eight days. Like, it didn't take him a long time to make it at all.
I don't know if it was that short, but Clint Eastwood is famous for working fast. Like, he famously usually only does one take of each shot.
Yeah, yeah. So
you have to have confidence to get away with that. Or you're lazy, but I don't think that's Clint Eastwood. He knows what he's getting, and he's got it, and he's not going to overthink it, and he's just going to move on. Tells the story. He usually gets out of the way of the story.
Yeah. Although he does have his own aesthetic, which I'm not always fond of. He's fond of this kind of cinematography where everything's a little bit glowy and a little bit washed out. He doesn't like bright colors.
Especially in the last 20 years or so. That's been his thing.
And he also likes, I guess because of his age, he scales back the pacing a little bit. His films are very casual. They don't really climax dramatically. They're a little bit more gentle about...
There are exceptions here. His early stuff was a lot more intense. Stuff like the High Plains Drifter.
Yeah.
And kind of everything up until at least for Unforgiven has a lot more energy to it than he would have later. But he really settled in.
Yeah.
And I think you can look at something like Mystic River, which is kind of an intense crime melodrama.
Mm.
And Million Dollar Baby, which has, you know, that boxing riff. But even Million Dollar Baby, he gets... The boxing thing is not the point.
Yeah.
The point is the very, very sad third act, and that's where you see that Clint Eastwood come into play.
And that's where it becomes a little bit of a better movie. Like the rise up and the sports stuff.
I actually disagree with that.
Oh, well.
I'm not a fan of Million Dollar Baby.
I'm not a huge fan either. It's not one of his better
really
movies.
Really heavy-handed.
But that's also his thing. He's really heavy-handed. He likes to play with broad melodrama.
Sometimes he has the good right material for it. I don't think Million Dollar Baby is a good script.
And I feel like he just charges ahead whether or not he has a good angle. They said, make a musical, film Jersey Boys, make a film of that.
Yeah.
It's like, okay, I'll just shoot that. No, you need a point of view on something like that. You need to be able to shoot music and have like an opinion on that music. Jersey Boys is awful.
It's not a good film. I'm not sure. I don't know if it could have been a great movie. It could have been better than that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So he's hit and miss, I think, because of his efficiency. He's just eager to get something on the screen. He's trying to make it as good as possible, just under the circumstances, but more than anything, he's just trying to finish it.
Well, he grew up in this sort of studio era. He came up in this studio era where, occasionally you're working with an auteur, but a lot of the time, we're just fucking making a movie here.
Yeah, and I think we're
trying to be efficient and make the studio happy, kind of.
And I feel like that's been his attitude for a lot. And then sometimes he knocks it out of the park.
Yeah.
Sometimes he makes stinkers.
What is juror number two?
Juror number two is pretty good.
Hey!
It stars Nicholas Holt.
Yay!
Good idea. However, Nicholas Holt is one of those actors who, for a second, they tried to make him sort of a romantic lead just because he's so good-looking. So he has, like, big attractive eyes and high cheekbones. He has kind of classical...
When did they try to make him romantic? I can't even remember that anymore. Because I remember him as a child actor. He was, like, about a boy. But... What did he have, like, a rom-com or, like, romantic hero phase?
He was the kid in About a Boy. what am I thinking of here?
I'm curious because I can only remember him as a more recent weirdo phase, which I say with absolute affection.
I'm just thinking of A Single Man, where he was like the younger guy in
kind of a beautiful romantic role, but fair enough.
Yeah, he was in a couple movies like what was that? Really awful drama, like melodramas, where he kind of played these ordinary characters.
Okay.
Dark Places. That was the one I was thinking.
It was the other one by the person who was it Gillian Flynn who wrote Gone Girl.
Yeah, I think
so. That's not a very good movie.
He played Tolkien in Tolkien.
That movie sucks. So that's not his fault, but that movie sucks.
But then throughout that, he's also playing like the Beast, like he's wearing the blue makeup in the X-Men movies, or he plays freaky guy in the Mad Max movie.
Yeah, he played Renfield in Renfield, which is one of the ultimate kooky roles.
Yeah, so I feel like he's always been stronger when he gets to play weirdos and kooks.
Yeah. Oh, The Menu. I love him in The Menu.
He's really great in The Menu. He's such a fucking sniveling little suck-up of a character.
Total Peter Lorre phase in The Menu. I love it. Anyway.
Here, I feel like Clint Eastwood just gave him sort of the role without necessarily knowing that his strengths are playing twitchy weirdos. Mm. So he's playing a really kind of boring character this time around. That's the film's biggest misstep is that he's playing a really ordinary guy. Nicholas Holt plays a character who has been called for jury duty. He tries to get out of it because his wife, who's played by Zoe Deutsch, who I really like.
Oh, yeah.
She's at home past her due date pregnancy.
Oh my God.
And he is trying to get out because he wants to be there just in case she goes into labor, but he has no real reason. This is in the state of Georgia.
Mm.
He's seated on a jury. Other recognizable faces on the jury, J.K. Simmons is there.
Okay.
And Toni Collette is the prosecutor. Chris Messina is the defense.
That's a really good cast.
Yeah. And we also learn later on, a little bit later on, that Kiefer Sutherland is in there playing his sponsor. He is a recovering alcoholic.
Oh, okay. All right.
So he's sitting on this jury. He doesn't want to be there. They're going through a murder trial. This man has been accused of killing his girlfriend and throwing her off a bridge during a rainy night. And when they're describing the case, and this happens early in the film.
Is that the premise?
This is the premise of the movie. Nicholas Holt is being described it. He starts having flashbacks. He realizes he was there at the scene of the crime when the couple was arguing and saw them run out. He ended up driving away. He hit what might have been a deer, but is now realizing is the victim. He ran her down in his car. And now he has to, as a juror, convince the jury to let this guy off the hook without implicating himself. It's like a John Grisham version of 12 Angry Men. There's a lot of deliberation,
yeah.
But we know that there's motivation behind the Henry Fonda character.
There was the John Grisham movie Runaway Jury, which was
Much more twisted.
It's much more twisted. That's a great movie, by the way.
Oh, yeah, that's really terrific.
But it's another one where like someone is on the jury, but they have their own agenda and they're manipulating the jury because of that agenda. Mm-hmm. Very different agenda, very different plot.
Yeah.
But it's interesting. I think it's
And what I like about the movie is we get that sort of plot machination. That's a good hook.
It's okay.
A juror realizes he committed the crime, and he's in an awkward position because he doesn't want to turn himself in because he'd get in trouble for that. But he also doesn't want to throw somebody else under the bus and like send him to prison for a crime he knows he committed. So there's a lot of like moral push and pull. He's really torn on what he wants to want. Because he does want to do the right thing, but he also doesn't want to do the right thing. He wants to get away with it. And as we go along, we realize how much people are seeing that there's like holes in the story, and they're kind of realizing that the case isn't as strong as maybe the prosecution made it look, just like in 12 Angry Men. So there's like,
what if Henry Fonda killed the guy?
Exactly. Like, exactly. That's the premise. The premise. What if 12 Angry Men, but what if Henry Fonda was the actual culprit? And it's great. I think a lot of the way they kind of slowly let the case unfold and how the Nicholas Holt character realizes he is becoming like more and more morally depraved. He's not like committing new crimes or anything, but he realizes more and more that he's a little bit more and more at peace with maybe the idea of letting somebody else pay for his crime.
See, that's the thing that interests me. And again, I missed this, unfortunately. They did not screen this. I think they had like one like AFI screening that some people went to. I wasn't able to get to that.
I think there was a screening, but it was like the hours before it opened on Thursday
night.
And
also, they've really dumped this. Like, there hasn't been a lot of advertising. It's not in that many theaters. Warner Brothers.
It's not being distributed at all.
Warner
which is
Brothers
weird for
is
a Clint Eastwood movie.
Well, Warner Brothers is making weird choices. Like apparently, like the last what was that last Clint Eastwood movie he did that
Cry
was
Macho.
Like, Cry Macho, which I like more than most people, but
that's all right.
Yeah, but regardless, it's like, you know, apparently like Zaslav and all the other like the new people in charge at Warner Brothers were like, why did we even make this? It's like, because it's Clint Eastwood. He works very fast, he works very cheap, and when he hits so hard. American
Oscars
Sniper
and
made
stuff.
So much money. like it happens, and it's kind of worth the minimal investment to like give it a try. And they apparently do not understand like why this movie even exists, and they really kind of dumped it. Which I'm like, you spent $200 million on Joker 2. Maybe don't trust your instincts. Like, that's maybe what you need. Question yourselves a little bit more. So maybe this could have been a bigger deal. But the thing that I'm wondering is, it sounds like this entire thing really needs to hinge on, can you by the moral dilemma? And that's the thing that I would like maybe struggle with something like this is, because me, I'd be like, okay, well, I just have to tell somebody and it's going to suck. That's not, you can't get a movie out of that.
We learn early on, like, he knows that there's going to be consequences to turning himself in.
Sure, of course.
Like, because he's a recovering alcoholic, they say, like, you, if you confess to this and you, and everybody believes you, they let this other guy off, he's going to be fine. But you will face at least 30 years in prison. Like, there's no getting around that. Mm-hmm. So it's like, okay, he knows what the consequences are. And then they start throwing in these other moral things. Like, he is a recovering alcoholic. He's changed his ways. He's trying to turn his life around. He's having a kid. He has this nice suburban home.
Meanwhile, getting away with murder is the moral thing to do.
Getting away with the murder is okay. Especially the guy who's innocent he's kind of a scumbag. And he's got neck tattoos. And he used to be a drug dealer and gangs and stuff. And he's hurt other people. And he was abusive. And he's actually kind of a dick. He didn't do that. But he's a horrible person otherwise. What's the moral
That's the
stance
thing.
Here?
That's the
yeah.
thing. It needs to engage on that
so
moral level, or it's not going to work at all. Okay.
It does. I think a lot of people might not be on Clint Eastwood's wavelength because he's such a gentle filmmaker. Mm-hmm. It doesn't have that kind of salacious, big
airplane novel kind of.
Airplane novel, I was going to say. A Time to Kill, like the Joel Schumacher movie.
Very sweaty melodrama on that. Yeah.
Incredibly sweaty. There's not a lot of like kind of sweaty intenseness to something like Juror Number 2. Mm-hmm. It's actually very, very dry and very calm. Which I prefer, because it lets us sort of focus a little bit more on the moral conflict that the main character is having.
There's also a problem with a lot of legal thrillers where, in order to beef up the thrills, the realities of the legal system are kind of thrown completely out the window, and it becomes ridiculous after a while.
We know that movie... There's actually a really great character who's brought in partway through the movie. She's one of the jurors, and she feels like she has special insight because she listens to a lot of true crime podcasts.
Ah, see, there you go.
So that's her angle. It's like, oh, I know all the way these sort of legal machinations work because I listen to a lot of true crime podcasts. Ah. Like, that's not reality, right? And so, but she's convinced it's real.
Yeah, sure.
So, yeah, I feel like Clint Eastwood gives each one of the jurors a little bit of personality. Hmm. Good casting on all of those characters. Really great performances from all the characters. And it ends perfectly.
Oh,
like,
good.
It's one of those, like, it's not nearly as good as the final shot from The Taking of Pelham 1-2-3.
Well,
but it is one of
movies.
It is one of those great, like, final shot movies where, like, the final moment is like, everything is wrapped up so nicely.
You know what movie gave me that recently? I finally caught up with Challengers. Great movie, by the way.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, finally caught up with it. Great final shot of
Challengers. The final shot of Challengers brings it all together.
It really does. Yeah. Like, it was good before that final shot, and then the final shot, I'm like, oh, nice. Well done, Challengers. So fair enough.
Although, I was frustrated at how not gay it was.
Like, it really felt like it was, we were promised something a lot gayer in the trailers.
We were promised something really kind of gay and titillating. It's like, hey, they almost had a threesome once. Really? You can't just let them have the threesome? Why do we have to be so prudish about those?
I don't know. Well, anyway, it sounds good and I'll have to check it out.
Yeah, it is good.
Awesome.
It is good.
Why do so many dogs die before their time? Actress and dog activist Katherine Heigl, who's helped save over 16,000 dogs through her foundation, says she's seeing more issues with dogs' joints, odors, and health than ever before. And after doing a ton of research, she feels there's one place we can look to support any dog's health: their food. So she decided to create something she could actually feel good about feeding her dogs. Superfood Complete by Badlands Ranch is made with over 30 of the healthiest ingredients on the planet, including premium protein-packed beef, nutrient-dense organ meat, heart-healthy salmon, gut-healthy vegetables, and several superfoods vital to your dog's health. And because high-heat cooking can add unhealthy things to your dog's food, Superfood Complete uses air drying, so it gets cooked low and slow. This means it has the convenience of kibble, but the health benefits of whole foods. If you want your dog to experience all these incredible benefits, go to BadlandsRanch.com/save50 right now to get up to 50% off your order and a 90-day money-back guarantee. Again, that's BadlandsRanch.com/save50 today. All dogs are unique. Your dog's results can and will vary.
I will take point on a new movie from Steve McQueen. By God, not the actor.
No, we were just talking about Occupied City.
Yeah, no, the director, Steve McQueen. He could have gone with, like, a middle initial in there to separate it, so we had done it to specify which Steve McQueen we're talking about every time, but it's fine. He is one of the best directors working today. Just period. I would argue, I didn't see Occupied City, but I maintain that his five-film quintet...
The Small Acts.
Small Acts is one of the great cinematic achievements of the decade.
It's great.
Just fucking phenomenal filmmaking. And he is back with a new World War II drama called Blitz, which...
takes place during the Blitz, I imagine.
Yeah, stick with me here. It takes place during the Blitz. The Blitz, if anyone is maybe less familiar with World War II, was the period in World War II when the Germans were actually flying over Britain and bombing the hell out of it. Just, like, bombing the hell out of London and all their occupied areas. And they caused enormous, you know, structural property damage. A whole lot of people died. A lot happened in that time period. Parents would send their children, like, up north to the countryside where the German bombers couldn't reach that far.
For the Chronicles of Narnia takes
place. That was the setup for that. And it's the setup for this movie, too. So, Saoirse Ronan plays a single mother in the early 1940s. And her son, who is black... And that is very important. She's living with him, and the Blitz is happening, and she needs to protect him. Uh-huh. So she puts him on a train. He feels completely betrayed by this, and he says, "I hate you." And then he gets on the train, and he just stares dead-eyed while she screams how sorry she is. Mm-hmm. And it's heartbreaking. Uh-huh. And then, After he's on the train for a little bit and he encounters some just awful fucking racist kids, he realizes suddenly, oh my God, I broke my mother's heart.
Aww.
So he jumps off the train makes his way home. And he is wandering home, wandering into these various, often very Dickensian kind of situations throughout the Blitz, looking for his mom, while his mom, for the first chunk of the movie, doesn't know he's missing. And we see what she's kind of going through in her own life. We see a few flashbacks, find out what happened to the kid's father. After a while, they're looking for each other in almost an American Tale kind of way, but without the anthropomorphic animals. Blitz is phenomenal. Blitz is a fantastic motion picture. It's a lot of movie.
So sorry I missed this.
It's so damn good, and it's good in a way that I think requires a bit of context that I don't think every American critic who I've seen tackle it seems to embrace or maybe fully understand. There is a history of the British propaganda film, made specifically during that era, where Britain was, in an order to bolster the war effort, was making movies about what's going on at home. The stories of the great heroes who are working right now, like ripped from the headlines, crank out a movie. This was the era in which we got Mrs. Miniver from the one Best Picture, one of the greatest propaganda movies ever made. And it is a story starring Greer Garson as a housewife just trying to keep her family together when every fucking night bombs are dropping on her community. It's harrowing. It's great drama. Amazing performances. You will cry at the end. It's fucking great. They made a lot of movies like that. But Steve McQueen is working in that tradition. He's doing this very, look at how tragic it is, what's happening to us. Look at this epic scale and this sort of Clark Gable, San Francisco kind of almost Irwin Allen enormitude of of the destruction. It's incredibly painted. But Steve McQueen rightly realizes that none of those movies talked about what people of color were going through at the time.
Yeah.
And so we see the war from multiple perspectives. You see from Saoirse Ronan's perspective, but also her son, who is wandering the streets as a black kid, being treated very differently because of it. There's a scene where he's, it's the middle of the night, and he's hungry. He's been living on the street for a few days. And he's looking in a shop window. And you've seen that scene in a movie, right? Where someone's hungry and they're looking at cake or whatever. And he's looking at this candy shop. And it's got all these candies. And he's a kid. He'd love candy. He's so hungry. He wants candy. And the shop window is advertising the candy as coming from Africa with these horribly racist depictions of people who, you know, he should be identifying with, and he refuses to, for a large chunk of the movie, he refuses to admit that he is a person of color. And it's only after encountering various people that he begins to understand his identity has dignity, not like what other people are telling him. There are these incredible sequences that Steve McQueen puts together, these like giant, glorious jazz nightclub, just delve into it. And I remember if it was one take or just felt like one take because it was so elaborate, but it's just these really gorgeous things. And then you hear the air raid sirens and you're like, oh my God, I know where this is going right now. There's horror in it. There's humor in it. There's, there's sentimentality. It's not afraid to go there. It's very large. It's very grand. It's very epic. There's this underwater rescue thing with the subway flooding. It's huge. It's a lot of movie. And it's the kind of thing that I think a lesser director would just film and talk about, like, oh, World War II, right? Am I right? Can I have my Oscar now? And Steve McQueen is giving you all of those things you expect from this kind of movie, but infusing them with a really fierce intelligence and social commentary that doesn't undermine the impressiveness of the production or the grandeur of the historical scale and the giant set pieces it's got all of that, but
you're it's so much more intelligent. That I missed that.
I'm mad that you missed it too, and I hope people see this. This is another one where this will be fine when you see it on home video. It's a great theatrical experience. Uh-huh. You really do feel like you've gone on a huge journey, and look, this similar movies have been done. You know, I've heard some people say, like, isn't it just kind of like Hope and Glory? Well, definitely similarities, but that's not this movie. It's its own thing. It is steeped in a cinematic tradition, which I don't think everyone, especially in America, is necessarily familiar with. But I think some of the reasons why other people are saying they don't like it are the exact reasons why I think it's brilliant.
Okay.
So, is it like Steve McQueen's most challenging work? No, because he's working within sort of almost a crowd-pleasing historical drama, take a drink, milieu. He's hitting that. He's not like saying I'm above that. I'm hitting that, but I am making the movie they probably should have made in the first place.
Here's what I appreciate about Steve McQueen as a filmmaker, because he started getting attention with films like Hunger
and Shame.
These things that are actually very kind of mannered and terse, very photographic.
Yeah.
Even 12 Years a Slave is very kind of staid in terms of its aesthetic. He's trying to frame things up in a way that make them feel a little bit artificial. And then you watch Small Axe, and you're like, holy shit, you can do so damn much, Steve McQueen.
Yeah.
Like, he's really tapping, like, it becomes really kind of natural and really kind of casual and deeply emotional. Not that there's, he's eschewing emotion, but they tend to be very mannered. And then he's making documentaries.
He started off as a painter. You know, like, he has a much more, he didn't just jump into film. He has more formal art education in many ways.
I feel like he's been evolving from an aesthetician, as it were, into somebody who's a little bit more interested in the human condition.
Yeah. No, I think that's fair. I think that's very true. And I think it's starting to feel more comfortable with it. And Blitz just feels like this, it just feels like everything. It feels Spielbergian. It feels Irwin Allenian. It feels, it feels Dickensian. Like, it really is like a whole, like, kind of a Fagin sequence in it that is very earned and very creepy. And
I'd say I wanted to take on Dickens, but it's been done.
We
don't need to see him do Dickens.
Listen, whatever he wants to do, I'm curious. He's earned my interest. Will he sometimes let me down? Maybe. I don't know. But at this point, I'm like, whatever you do, like, it's like when Greta Gerwig is like doing Chronicles of Narnia. Yeah. I'm like, that isn't necessarily what I would have asked Greta Gerwig to do. But after Lady Bird and doing what she miraculously did with Barbie, yeah, whatever you want. Like, I'm going to give you the benefit of the doubt until you show me I shouldn't. Because you're killing it right now. And Steve McQueen has been killing it for a while. And I think he's only getting better. I know 12 Years a Slave was, you know, kind of universally acclaimed it won Best Picture. But I think he's
the awards darling, but he's better than that, actually.
Yeah, I'm not decrying that movie. I just think that I think he's actually improved since then. I think he's made even better films. So, yeah, this is a great movie. It's not getting such attention as I think it deserves. And if you can see it in a theater, I highly recommend it. But see it wherever you can, because I think it's great. And then I think we should end on the documentary because it's a bit of a big one.
It's
a big topic.
Yeah, it's
And I have two others, and I don't have a lot to say about them. So I'm gonna this pretty short.
Tell me about Taken 8 or whatever it's
okay,
called.
Okay, so there's a new Liam Neeson movie. It is called Absolution, which is a very pretentious title for a movie.
Hang on. Sorry, I almost fell asleep when you were just describing that.
Liam Neeson's had an interesting career, and he spent most of it, like at least the first half of it, kind of balancing like serious dramas and independence with the occasional studio flick. You know, he was Darkman, you know, or he was Rob Roy, which wasn't really a studio flick, but it was a grand sort of action historical piece. And it's a great movie, actually. And ever since Taken, though, he occasionally does something else, but mostly he's been focused on the action genre.
Well, he was a boxer.
Yep.
He's even said, I think he himself said in some interviews, that's what gave him his profile.
Yeah.
Because he got hit in the nose a couple times.
Yeah.
But then I think it was Schindler's List that really kind of turned him around into sort of a dramatic star. And then he was kind of a Hollywood power player in dramas and action films for a while.
Yeah.
And then Taken was what turned him into just sort of an action hero. Now,
and again, he'd done action.
A large portion
He'd done
career.
Action before, but he became kind of like the Charles Bronson of his generation.
Yeah.
Where he's playing an older man in almost all of these movies. He is usually world weary and or grizzled. He encounters some sort of strife and he punches it and shoots it until it stops. And usually, somehow, this ends up healing his family. He's the angry but awesome dad.
Well, he represents a very specific fantasy
that
a lot of angry dads have, that they can be grizzled and mean, but their grizzled and meanness is actually going to prove to be a virtue in some point and will save their family.
It'll
be right all along.
It's very common for him to, like, appeal to kids like, I don't like my dad, and then he, like, beats up all the terrorists, and the kids are like, good job, Dad. I now respect you. I think the ultimate Liam Neeson movie is actually a fake Liam Neeson movie that he was in, in the movie Daddy's Home 2. Because there's a bit in Daddy's Home 2 where it's Christmas and everything is closed except the movie theater. So they go into a movie theater and it's playing a Liam Neeson movie called Mistletoe, T-O-W. And we never see it, but we hear Liam Neeson. It's actually Liam Neeson on the audio. And, these two kids are saying, Daddy, you killed them! And Liam Neeson says, no, children, we killed them together as a family. And that's kind of the whole thing in a nutshell. These movies that he's been making since Taken, some of them are good. Most of them are interchangeable and forgettable. Mm. Which brings us to Absolution. So in Absolution, he is an old gangster who's literally credited as Thug in the credits. Like, he doesn't even get a name.
Okay.
He has been doing the gangster shtick for 30 years. He is a veteran of it. He knows it all. It doesn't faze him anymore. And he's even, like, his boss is played by Ron Perlman. And Ron Perlman has a son who wants to get into the crime business, and Liam Neeson is showing him the ropes. Mm-hmm. The problem is that Liam Neeson is starting to have trouble remembering things.
Oh, like, interesting.
Like his boss's name or where he lives.
Okay.
And this is the cleverest scene in the whole movie. Is there's a bit where his job today is to go to this, like, horrifyingly corrupt doctor and buy, like, oxycodone off of him. And it's just like this giant box of illicit drugs. And while he's taking the drugs, he's like, oh, by the way, I've been experiencing some memory loss. Is that something I should check out? And the guy's like, yeah. So he does, and it turns out he's been concussed so many times over his life, from his abusive childhood to working as a boxer, I'm sure crime didn't help, that he's now experiencing cognitive decline, and it's only going to get worse, and within a year or two, he'll be unable to take care of himself. So what are you going to do, Liam Neeson? What are you going to do? Well, he's going to be sad for about 2 hours. He's going to try to reconnect with his daughter and grandson.
I don't mind Sad Boy Liam Neeson.
I don't mind Sad Boy Liam Neeson if it's interesting. Unfortunately, we have Absolution. He tries to reconnect with his daughter and his grandson. The goes through the motions there. And also, he might, like, suddenly feel bad about all the human trafficking he's been doing. And maybe he might want to do something about that at the last possible fucking minute. And that's one of those things where it's like, okay, listen, I'm with you.
He's doing the human trafficking?
He's not, like, leading it, but he's, like, driving the trucks.
Okay.
And, like, dropping them off, and he sees them being taken out and being forced into sex work, and it's horrifying. And it's one of those things where it's like, you tell me he's led a hard life and he's done a lot of crime, but he's now sad and no one loves him, and you've got my sympathy a little bit. You show me that he's been doing human trafficking, and you have lost me. I no longer feel that bad for him.
Well, if it's that kind of, like, moral twist, it's like you feel kind of sorry for him, but then, like, they pull the rug out from under you in that Michael Haneke way, and it turns out
evil man.
Like, he's a monster, and
they don't do that.
They tricked you into, like, feeling sympathy for
that
a monster.
That would have been exciting. Yeah. Like, that would have been great, actually. Mm-hmm. They'll do a Liam Neeson movie where instead of being the aging criminal or spy or whatever who was always a good guy but no one appreciated him, what if he was always a piece of shit?
Yeah, what if he was the criminal last time?
Which,
yeah.
Really, in most movies, he would be. Like, one of my favorite it's not a good movie, but...
Taken, he's a villain.
Well, that's what I love about Taken, too. It doesn't really go far enough with this, but the premise of Taken 2 is all of those people he murdered in Taken had families and they want revenge, as well they would, because if Liam Neeson was those guys, he would be trying to kill Liam Neeson too. That's an interesting premise, and especially at the beginning when Liam Neeson is taken and now Maggie Grace has to solve all the problems.
Right.
That was a great setup. And then halfway through the movie, they're just like, okay, we're bored with this, just bring Liam Neeson back. No, you were doing fine!
They free him and it goes back to...
No!
If Maggie Grace had been the main character, that would have been great.
It would have been solid. Oh, God, it's not as bad as Taken 3, though.
Few things are as bad as Taken 3.
I stand by what I said about Taken 3. Taken 3 makes Taken 2 look like Taken. It's a solid line and I stand by it. This isn't doing anything interesting with it. It's just don't know, isn't it sad? And I'm like, I guess a little. The more I think about it, like, the more, like, and I don't think this is intentional because the movie never really gets us to this point. If you look at this as a story about someone who spent their career engaging in empty acts of violence and now they have nothing left.
Oh.
And if you try to think of this as a commentary on Liam Neeson's action movie career, maybe you'd have something.
Mm.
It's like, was Commuter really worth it? I could have spent time with my family. You know, that kind of
right.
thing. Like,
well, that's,
that could have been something, but it's not self-aware or intelligent enough for that.
I feel like a lot of action movies try to tap into that. They try to catch up with a character who's a little bit older, or they've already committed so much violence, or maybe they're a former cop or soldier, where we catch up with them and they're like, they're already in the bar. They're like leaned over a drink. Nah, I've given up that life.
You know, come on, one last job, McCluskey.
And it turns out they're still capable. You know, they're trying to tap into this idea that committing these acts of violence will destroy your soul.
But then committing acts of violence rejuvenates the soul.
I know,
always,
that's,
every time.
That's the irony in a lot of these movies. I feel like, and even bigger blockbusters are trying to do that. Like, let's catch up with Indiana Jones when he's 80. What's he doing?
Wolverine is sad.
Yeah, Wolverine, these are all, you know, Luke Skywalker, these are all sad old men now. Why? Because they killed so many people.
Yeah.
They feel terrible about what they've done. Their lives don't reward them.
The thing that you think is awesome about them is the thing that destroyed them, which it in real life.
Which it would in real life, and also, if we keep on living with them, we get to see them live with those consequences. At the end of the first Star Wars movie, we don't care. Luke Skywalker is happy. He won the day. He fought a battle, and he got out okay.
It's been a hell of a week.
Yeah, and he gets a medal, and from a pretty princess, and he's great.
Mm-hmm.
It's not even his sister yet. what happened till a later movie? But we catch up with him when he's an old man. It's like, I've seen, you know, we triumphant and then we fell again and then we fell again and then we rose and we fell. The cycle is tiring. I'm done.
Yeah.
Like, I don't need to do this anymore. There's no such thing as a hero or a villain. There's just people killing each other all the time.
Yeah. Which is profound, really.
Which I think that's a great comment. I feel like when we catch up with these people and their lives are ruined, that's fine.
Because
action ruins your life.
A problem is
murder
that,
ruins your life.
And I think I agree with that, but a lot of the movies only use that as a prelude to getting your mojo back.
Yeah, well,
you know,
I
like,
mean,
well, like
when,
Wolverine,
when it does.
Wolverine gets his mojo back by becoming a badass guy again and stabbing a bunch of people in Deadpool and Wolverine. You know, like it's
well,
not
in Deadpool
really
and Wolverine,
nothing
but,
profound.
But
about
you watch Logan; it's like he's going to stab people, but he doesn't want to.
That's actually
he
great...
realizes this is not going to help him.
That's actually a great point. Like, and you know, Logan's a great movie. It's I'm not as quite as high on it as it was when it came out, but it's a great movie.
I really like Logan.
Logan's great. I tell anyone to see Logan. It's one of the better superhero movies. But seeing that they're both telling the same story of a guy who doesn't want to do this anymore. He's seen a lot of hardship. He's seen all the X-Men die. And then he gets pulled back in for one last job, except one of them has meaning and one of them doesn't.
Yeah.
And here, Absolution is going for meaning, but it's just too fucking thin. Like, it's very perfunctory in all of the things that it does, and nothing hits. Nothing hits. It's not interestingly, like, filmed. It's actually just very dreary. It does this... Oh, God, there's this horrible thing it does, which... This needs to be, like, in a... Like, when you join the industry, like, in any job, they should just give you a list of don't do these things. If you're a composer for a movie, don't put in your score a light, rhythmic buzzing noise that sounds exactly like someone's cell phone going off. Yeah. Huge chunks of the movie.
Oh, gosh.
Have that. And I'm watching this at home, the way most people always will. And every single time I'm like, oh, I thought I put that on airplane. But no, God damn it. And every few minutes, I'm like, well, that could be my mom. No, damn it. Like, stop that. Don't do that. What do you... Nah. Anyway, Absolution. It is absolutely not good.
Hey.
The next one I want to talk about quickly is Time Cut. Time Cut.
I don't even know this movie.
It was Netflix's last minute Halloween release. They just threw out a horror movie like the day before Halloween. Time Cut comes from a director who's like relatively new. She did some like TV on like Hulu. Her name is Hannah McPherson, but she co-wrote it or rewrote it. I don't know. Whatever. With I guess rewrote it because he's credited with the story. The other screenwriter is Michael Kennedy. If you don't know Michael Kennedy has found a niche for himself. He wrote Freaky,
Okay.
Which was, what if Freaky Friday was a slasher movie?
Did he also do Totally Killer?
No, that he did It's a Wonderful Knife, which was, what if It's a Wonderful Life was a slasher movie?
Mm-hmm. Which, and, you know, that's fine.
Yeah, these are fine elevator pitches.
These are fine ideas, yeah.
And honestly, both of those, especially Freaky, good movies.
I like Freaky.
Freaky was especially well, like, performed and directed, but it had a really sharp script. It knew how to make that premise work. It's a Wonderful Knife, really sharp script, not an amazing production. It feels like it's a little on the cheaper side, but the script is so good, it works. Time Cut is what if Back to the Future, but a slasher.
Which was Totally Killer.
Which was Totally Killer, I'll grant you this. Yeah. And I actually missed Totally Killer, and I need to get around to it, but...
Totally Killer is, like, just last year.
Yeah, it was very, very
recent.
It was
a time travel slasher movie.
And again, this is the sort of thing where, like, if it had come out the same year, we'd be calling it, like, a twin movie, like Volcano and Dante's Peak, etc. So yeah, there was a slasher in a small town, killed a bunch of people, and then disappeared. One of the girls who died, her parents, like, very shortly afterward, had another kid, and now that kid is about to graduate from high school, and she's been living in the shadow of her dead sister this entire time, as indeed the entire town has been living in the shadow of this tragedy. It's the anniversary of the event. She travels with her family to the place where her sister died to, you know, memorialize, talk. And she kind of wanders off a little bit and sees in a shed nearby, there's a time machine.
Okay.
She doesn't know it's a time machine at first, but she turns it on and she winds up back in the far-off year of 2003.
Okay, when was Back to the Future made?
85.
What year do they travel to?
55.
30 years.
This is 20 years.
All right.
Time moves a little faster now. Mm-hmm. And now we have nostalgia for a much sooner period. Now,
well, we are both old enough to experience, like, waves of nostalgia. We saw our own youths get sold back to us.
The 80s and the 90s.
And now we finally reached the point where we're seeing waves of nostalgia and remakes of things that we were too old to consume in the first place.
Well, a little bit, because, you know, she's in high school, and she goes into the high school, and the high school is filled of, like, lots of bare midriffs and UGG boots.
Yeah.
Like, a lot of them. And, like, chunky iPods and Discmans.
We were hoping they'd roll with that a little bit more in Madame Web, which also takes place in the early 2000s.
Like, have some fun with it. Go full Wedding Singer. But, and, like, people with, like, those wheelies on the back of their heels.
Those are still, like, around.
I know, but those were hip and new at the time. Which just goes to say, you know, if you roll your eyes at, like, you know, people having nostalgia for time periods, it's going to happen to you. There's a lot of people, they put out, like, that clip of just this bit of her, like, walking down the hallway in the high school, just being kind of horrified by the fashions. Uh-huh. And I'm like, this is every movie about traveling back to the 70s. This is every movie about traveling back to the 60s and the 50s. They all have this scene, and now you don't like it because you were alive when that shit was actually happening. And people are like, well, it wasn't quite like that. Yeah, guess what? The 50s weren't liking Back to the Future either. It's a fucking movie. And everything, all the nuance from history eventually gets filtered out, and all younger generations know are, like, the main bullet points.
Yeah,
like the fads. Like, the 70s was more than bell bottoms and big hair. But that's what young people know.
I feel like 90s nostalgia didn't quite nail it, because it didn't get the sort of disaffected MTV attitude in a lot of the remakes. It's more just the pops, like the early 90s pop stuff.
Yeah, the 90s was a bit more of an eclectic decade, and I think it was a little harder to nail down in some ways than some of the others, because they didn't really have, like, one unifying sort of aesthetic for a lot of it. Like, there were a lot of, like, different, like, sub-aesthetics kind of fighting itself. Like, I don't see enough 90s movies where everyone is wearing a t-shirt, jeans, and flannel wrapped around their waist.
Yeah.
That's a whole thing from, like, 92 to 94 that everyone was doing, and it has vanished, and that's not in a movie anymore.
I want to see a 90s movie where somebody goes to a club, and they see somebody wearing those Cat in the Hat hats that the raver kids were wearing at the time.
Those fucking hats.
Take an E and listening to EMF, you know, it's...
Anyway, long story short, she goes back in time, and she has a dilemma. Do I change time? I know this guy's going to kill people. I know where they're going to die. Mm. Do I do something about it? And she also befriends her sister back when she was still alive.
Oh, okay.
And the quandary is, do I do the immediate good of stopping someone from dying right in front of me? Or do I run the risk of doing the, or do I focus on the greater good of not fucking up the future? Because for all I know.
These are all in Totally Killer. You're describing Totally Killer.
I'm sure I am. These are, and it's the part that writes itself.
Yeah.
Honestly. And again, I can't speak to Totally Killer. Well, let me ask you this about Totally Killer. Maybe there's like a difference. Did Totally Killer suck?
No, it was actually pretty entertaining.
Okay, so there are differences. Because
there's a cute bit in Totally Killer where she goes back in time, she meets sort of her mom's generation.
Yeah.
And they're like sneaking around doing naughty slasher movie things, like I'm gonna go have sex in the bedroom and I'm gonna smoke weed, and she takes some of their weed and she like takes a hit of it, it's like, oh, this weed sucks.
I'm gonna
give you some like edibles and you won't be able to move your face. Like,
little
details like that, you know, I like that.
Yeah, no, it's frustrating how unclever it is and how it's not funny enough to really work as a comedy. Mm. It's not character driven enough to really sell the emotions of it. Like, there's some good stuff with like getting to know the sister you never had, and also there's a twist halfway through it where she says, okay, what if I do save my sister? But I was born after my sister died, and my parents might not have tried if she'd lived. Shit, what do I do? Which, that's a quandary. That's actually a little complicated. So I wish they'd done more with that. But the thing that really stinks about it is it's a shitty slasher movie.
So there's not even, like, fun kills?
There's definitely not fun kills. No, it feels
interesting,
like,
monster killer?
No, definitely not interesting monster killer. It looks like, and they don't really call attention to it, it looks like he's wearing a Donald Trump mask.
Okay.
But I don't know if that's a coincidence or not. It doesn't look like a branded one, but it just looks like if you were like...
It'd be interesting if they go back to like when The Apprentice was new and right. like they're trying to like renew Trump's brand at that
like,
point.
There's a lot like of things you could do with the politics of that could be really, really interesting. And indeed, what if you could go back in time and affect politics? I feel like that's something we would fantasize about now. Mm. But yeah, no, the slasher stuff sucks. And they got like sometimes there's like a slasher movie and it feels like they were trying to cut it back to like a PG-13. This feels like they were trying to cut it back to a PG. Like it feels very tame. So the kills aren't interesting. The characters aren't interesting enough. Like most of the people who would be killed by the slasher, just fodder. I don't really care. The motivation for the killer when we find it out makes no fucking sense. Not even in like a fun, ridiculous way, but in a... Did you think this movie out kind of way? Like, did you talk to anybody before we put this in front of a camera? Because that doesn't work. Also, this movie's hacked to pieces. Like, so much dialogue happens while people's backs are to the camera that it really feels
they're really trying to save it.
They're trying to save it or they're trying to unruin it. I can't tell. Maybe they cut good stuff out and there was like the studio wanted to shift. I don't know. But it's clearly a hack job, and I mean literally, like, in the editing room. The sound isn't very good. There's, like, a lot of ADR that's really obvious ADR. Like, when you can tell, like, two people are talking in the same room, but one of them has, like, more echo on them, so you can tell they were recorded somewhere else. That happens a lot. There's a scene where, like, a guy's talking in a hallway, a high school hallway, to some other girls, and he sounds like he's in another room, and he's, like, a lot louder than them. But then there's, like, one line of dialogue where he sounds like he is in the same room as them, but the boom mic was too far away, and I'm like, why didn't you ADR that part, too? What is the problem that the production sucked? Is the problem that the post-production sucked? Both? Like, I don't know, but, like, it's very clearly a film that is patched together. And it's frustrating because I know at the very least the screenwriter is capable of doing something fun with this kind of premise. Freaky is great. It's a Wonderful Knife is really good. And, yeah, this has been done very recently, but there's no reason why this had to suck. It did, but there's no reason why it had to. And I don't know exactly... I don't know who's to blame... But I can point out all the things in the movie that don't work. And there's way too many, and it leads to the movie sucking. So it's quite unfortunate. And that's all I have to say about that.
Okay.
Now tell me about a documentary, damn it.
All right. I'm going to tell you about No Other Land. And No Other Land is going to break your fucking heart.
Oh, God damn it.
No Other Land is co-directed by four different filmmakers, but the main director, the one we see on camera the most, is named Basil Adra. And he is an Israeli journalist who is detailing he is the son of an activist. And one of his early memories is watching his dad get arrested at a protest. It wasn't the first time he saw his dad get arrested at a protest, and it hadn't been the first time his dad got arrested at a protest. So he has that sort of observational spirit and a strong sense of injustice. He is looking into an area of Palestine in the West Bank called Masafar Yatta. And Masafar Yatta has been designated by the Israeli soldiers as a training ground, military training ground. And everybody has to get out. And they live there. And the Israelis, and they are trying to appeal to the government. Well, wait a minute. If we have to move, what are we going to do? Well, they're just, if you don't move, they're just going to tear your house down. We're going to bring in bulldozers. We're just going to tear your house down and you have to leave. They said, okay, can we build a new spot? Well, yes, but you need a permit. Is there a way to get a permit? No. They're just going to be kicked out. And he details the frustrating process of how these people are being displaced and how the Israeli soldiers are moving in and just being so unbearably, casually cruel for no fucking reason. There is a moment where one of them is driving a bulldozer toward one of their houses. They weren't told that to get out. They just knew that these bulldozers were coming. And the bulldozer's coming, and she's running out of her house. All of her stuff is still in there. Her daughters are still in there. And she says, wait a minute, my kids are in there. We stop your bulldozer. And they just say, don't care. And they just keep on running it through. Kids get out, maybe. Somebody is grievously injured. He's paralyzed. There's no medical attention. They can't get him out to a hospital. There's also a little bit of accusation on journalists' part who go in, record the tragedy, and then drive away. These people are still suffering. The part that really broke my heart is when the Israeli soldiers come in and they've managed to set up this kind of rudimentary system where they have like tubes and plumbing going to the local well. And the Israeli soldiers cut the water lines, just physically with axes, just start cutting it, and then they fill the well with cement. This is about the systematic destruction of this area and just trying to wipe out the people. Displace them until they have nowhere to go. Just make them gone. And this is what's happening now. This film was completed before October.
Before last October.
Before last October. So it was already happening, this like encroachment, this occupation of Israeli forces.
Yeah, a lot of people are only kind of recently aware of what's going on in that part of the world. And it's complicated, granted, but it goes back really far. It is not new at all. And if all you know is what you've heard in the last year, you have a lot of research to do. And I'm not going to pretend to educate anybody right now because I'm no expert in it, but I do recommend do a lot of reading because it's really complicated.
It's really complicated. Get to know that. Yeah. Now, what this film does is, I feel like if you're paying attention to the news or if you have done the reading, you kind of understand the politics and, you know, it's not going to go into all of the history of it for you. It assumes you should know.
Yeah. That movie doesn't have to tell you everything.
Yeah, it's not going to give, it's not like this gentle film for ignorant Americans who need to be walked through some of the history. You know the history. Or at least go to get to know the history.
You have access to it.
It's putting a human face on the utter cruelty and how war just has robbed these people of their humanity and how oppression and constant violence is just part of the landscape now. And how helpless we all feel in the face of it. And that's the movie. That's what this film is about. That's what it's trying to capture, and it does it. And if it doesn't rip your goddamn heart out, then I'm not sure if you had one. There is so much pain and so much violence going on right now. You need to be aware of it. At the very least, to motivate you to do something, or at the very least, understand what it is that we are sort of complicit with. They actually talk about the American government in this movie.
Yeah, that was an issue before last year, too.
If we were to do this, or if we were to take these videos, we could show it to the American government, and they would intervene in some way.
Yeah, that's not how life actually works.
One of the other directors is really... because this is like modern journalism. They just whip out their phones, film it, and post it online.
Like that minute.
As it's happening. And one of the directors is concerned because he's making these short videos or he's shooting on like Instagram and he's not getting a lot of hits. Yeah. And he's really concerned. Well, what if we got a lot of hits? We would like alert people to the tragedy and something would change. And meanwhile, the director we keep on seeing, Basel Adra, is a little bit more at peace with the fact that a lot of hits on an Instagram post isn't going to change what's happening. Mm-mm. It's going to take a much larger kind of sea change in the entire region and with the government and with military attitudes before something like this can cease.
Yeah, in America as well. Like we're seeing a huge shift.
Yeah,
I think in relatively recent times. But yeah, that's the fucking thing. Like we have this idea, and movies still try to sell us on this.
Uh-huh.
That if we just make people aware of this injustice, the movie can be over. Because we know the government will help. Or people won't stand for it and they'll protest or they won't vote for people who want to. It turns out that's not how that works.
No,
they make it very, very difficult to exact any real change, even if you want to.
It is difficult, too, when you're making a film like this that is a work of journalism. It's trying to inform the viewer. There's a temptation to put, like, here's where you can donate money, or here's how you can help at the end of it, trying to turn it into a bit of a cause documentary. That's not this. This is not necessarily trying to motivate people to sort of, like, local action. There are plenty of great films that do that, where if there is some sort of, like, local political change that you can do in your neighborhood, that it's encouraging you to do those things. But that tends to be about something kind of gentler, like, help restore a library or, work at a homeless shelter.
Things something that feel a little bit more low impact, like on you, like a little bit, you can.
Well, something that you're capable of doing.
That's my point.
Something that you can do that's like nearby.
Like exactly my point. You can be helpful. Certainly. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying it's a bad thing, but you can do it from the comfort of your own home or you can do it on the weekend and you actually will see a tangible change and that's good. But the bigger issues, the crises, the ones that are hurting the most people in a lot of ways. It takes a lot of work.
People aren't necessarily
willing to do that. And the ones who are often get shat on.
Yeah. Like people I think what the film is trying to make explicit is the true volume of violence and injustice that is happening right now.
Yeah.
That the American, if you're an American audience, the American government is complicit in.
And has been for a very long time.
Has been
like
for
multiple,
a long time.
Multiple, like, administrations, and both parties have been a party to it.
A lot of news media in America doesn't cover this sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. Or if they do, they cover it from one very specific angle, and they kind of gloss over a lot of it,
So, see the movie.
Yeah.
Be informed.
Yeah.
Be outraged. Be heartbroken.
Yeah.
Because that's what this film is trying to communicate to you.
Yeah.
It's maybe one of the more important films of the year.
Yeah.
It's difficult to call a film like this one of the best of the year because that means it's like kind of glittering. I don't even want to put it in those terms.
That suggests that it's like I don't know. That suggests that it's not horrifying.
Yeah. It is truly horrifying.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
So
documentaries.
You got to see shitty Liam Neeson movies and slasher movies, and I'm getting my heart ripped out by tragedy in Palestine.
And we're not the same, you and I. that's awful, man.
Drawn to different films, I guess.
But listen, I'm glad these movies are being made, and I'm glad they're being seen, and it's a shame they have to be made. But well. On that note,
let's review some films.
Yeah, on that note, let's review films on the critically acclaimed scale. The critically acclaimed scale runs from C- to C+. The lowest we can give a movie is a C-. Mm-hmm. Excuse me. Those movies we don't recommend. Those movies are below average. A movie that is a C is a movie that's a bit of a mixed bag. Most movies average out that way. And a C+ is an above average movie. These are movies we genuinely recommend, whether we think they're merely quite good or genuinely great. On that note, No Other Land.
No, I mean, it's a C+.
Sounds like.
This is one, it's kind of like a must-see for, if you're concerned with world politics at all, Yeah, definitely check this one out.
All right.
But no, it's rough going in.
Yeah, it sounds it. Let's see. Time cut. C-. It feels like something happened here. It feels like there was, like, probably a good idea. Movie was made in good faith. And it feels like something happened during the production that just chopped it to pieces and prevented it from being better than it is. Mm-hmm. It's a shame, but it doesn't make the movie any better. So C-. Absolution, C-. It's not, like, inept. It just, what it does isn't very interesting.
Okay.
And when it's almost interesting, it finds the least interesting way to do it. So, yeah, Liam Neeson has been in better films. C-. Blitz, huge C+.
All right.
I
really want to see Blitz. Yeah, it sounds so good.
It's a giant production. It's a really impressive watch. It's very absorbing. You go on an emotional roller coaster, but it doesn't feel like manipulative in a false way. It feels manipulative in a genuine way, if that makes sense. Great performances, really smart, kind of getting overlooked, and I don't know why. It's excellent. C+. Juror number two.
Juror number two is a high C. It's just a good, capable courtroom thriller with a good premise. I like how gentle it is. It could stand to have a little bit more energy. I feel like it might have even benefited a little bit from being like salacious and a little bit more sensational.
Yeah,
but it's still entertaining. I like all the cast is really, really great. And yeah, Clint Eastwood still has great attention to detail as a director.
All right, and then lastly, Robert Zemeckis is here, which I would say is a C. Plus a minus sign. Like, just put a minus sign next to that C and you got it. It's an ambitious premise that they do very little with. Shockingly little.
It's a wonderful idea, that they just Zemeckis didn't have a point to. It's definitely a C-.
Yeah.
I hesitate to call one of the worst of the year, but it is, like, it feels one of the most useless films I've seen. I was upset afterwards.
There's a lot of bad films that aren't, like, probably don't have a chance to be great just because of their material or the talent involved or whatever. And so when they turn out to be bad, you're like, okay, it's bad, but okay. Here, they've got a brilliant cast. They got a director who's made brilliant films. They have a distinct concept that could have been very unique and fascinating.
Slick as all get out.
Oh, very slick.
Zemeckis knows how to make a movie.
Very slick. I mean, you got Alan Silvestri doing the score. Like, all the pieces are there, but they amount to next to nothing. So it really stands out that this movie is bad, whether or not it's one of the worst of the year. And that is it for Critically Acclaimed this week. Next week, we'll be back with reviews of The Piano Lesson and The Best Christmas Pageant Ever, which are not related. It's not about people learning the piano so they can work in the Christmas pageant. Two different films.
When is Hot Frosty coming? I want to hear that one.
That's in 2 weeks. Netflix does have another Christmas movie coming out next week, and it's got a really generic title. It's like Meet Me for Christmas or something like that. But Hot Frosty, the one where Lacey Chabert, I assume, fucks a snowman, but she definitely wants to.
She wants to fuck a snowman.
Yeah, imagine the movie Jack Frost if, like, the snowman was hot and instead of, like, a... It was just like a single woman.
Do you want to boink a snowman? Sorry.
Yes, apparently.
I apologize.
Okay. It looks like, even just the
title's the title's Hot Frosty, so I'm excited.
The cover looks like a Chuck Tingle novel. Like, it just looks like, bless him for it. I hope it's even half as good as it sounds, or at least half as entertaining as it sounds.
I was about to make a Chuck Tingle joke, but it's far too inappropriate.
Probably not. We're going to move on. Thank you for listening. Thank you for joining us. Please subscribe if you haven't already. If you want to listen to more exclusive shows, if you want to listen to our regular shows ad-free, you can head on over to patreon.com/criticallyacclaimednetwork, where we have a lot of exclusive material, like a lot, like hundreds of hours of exclusive material just waiting for you. And all of that's fun. And a fish. What am I forgetting? Social media. Yeah. We're on social media at Critic Acclaim. I am at William Bibbiani.
I'm at Whitney Seibel.
If you want to talk about anything we discussed on the podcast today, we would love to hear from you. Our email address is letters@criticallyacclaimed.net.
Yes, indeed.
Whitney, what is our P.O. Box?
Yeah, send us a physical letter or a postcard or whatever you like to the Critically Acclaimed Network, P.O. Box 641565, Los Angeles, California, 90064.
Yeah, and when we get enough correspondence, we will do another episode of We've Got Mail, so that's right. Send it along. Anyway, thank you very much. Please vote. You got this episode is coming out.
If you're in the United States, vote.
Yeah. If you haven't voted already, and many people have had the opportunity, please vote. And if you have voted, make sure you track your vote. Make sure you don't need like a provisional ballot or something that got lost in the mail. But like, seriously, it's a big fucking deal. Every year, it's a big fucking deal. But this one, there's a lot riding on it. So we encourage you to head out to your polls. Send in that mail-in ballot if you haven't already. Do what you gotta do. And remember to vote locally as well. That's where a lot of the change happens.
Yeah.
Don't just think about, like, the presidential race. Think about every single one. Do your research. There's lots of good voting guides online for whatever city, state, county you're in. So do some research. Good luck out there. Let's make the world a better place. Thank you once again. And never forget, everyone is a critic.
I wanna go to the midnight show. I'm sorry, what?
Why choose a Sleep Number smart bed?
Can I make my side softer?
Can I make my side firmer?
Can we sleep cooler?
Sleep Number does that. Cools up to 8 times faster and lets you choose your ideal comfort on either side, your Sleep Number setting. And now, during our Veterans Day sale, save 40% on the Sleep Number Special Edition smart bed. Limited time. To find a store near you, visit sleepnumber.com.